Hey, Ben.
Starting a podcast. Please be quiet.
Okay. This is Unorthodox, the universe's leading Jewish podcast. I am Stephanie Butnick, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, tablet editor-at-large Leah Leibovitz.
Shalom.
And World Pickleball Association Los Angeles Men's 50-plus bronze finalist, Joshua Molina.
Yes, I'm number three. Don't ask me how many teams there were.
Our first guest this week is Andrew Goldberg. He is the director of a new documentary called Armenia, My Home. It just aired on PBS, and Liel and Joshua talked to him all about it. And then we interview Alon Levy, the official spokesperson of the Israeli government, about fighting the war on the digital front. But first, what's new with you guys?
I mean, first of all, look, I'm sorry, number three pickleball champ in all of Greater Los Angeles? I need to hear a lot more about this.
Well, this is a specific tournament. I played with my partner, Vladimir Eugene, in the 50s plus men's doubles event. There were, in fact, 10 teams, and we came in third. My greatest achievement of the week.
I used to have a fencing coach who always preferred to be third place versus second, because third place means you like win for third and you lose for second. So I would like to extend you that grace and that philosophy.
Thank you. Yes, that's what we were trying to do. We were trying to win for third.
I'm sorry, but how are you so calm about this? If I won third place in anything, you'd be hearing about this for months, maybe even years. You're still like, oh, yes, you know, there are 10 other teams.
I'm hashtag humble.
Can we talk about the other teams? Who are the other teams? What were their weaknesses? Tell us about some of your greatest moments.
If you play pickleball, there are two real types of players. There are bangers who hit the ball really hard and at the other person. That is what we are like. And there are people who have more nuanced, finessed games where you dink and play soft drop shots and whatnot. And that's what the better players really do. I'm just good at hitting it hard at other people.
Bangers and droppers.
I hope to expand my game in the future.
So, okay, this is LA. How, like, star-studded is any given tournament for any given sport?
It's so not star-studded that I if there were a name in the tournament, it would be me.
And it was you.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, not that anyone was excited to be, but I recognized me.
I feel like there should have been a special t-shirt that was like, I was whacked with a pickleball by Joshua Molina.
Pickleballers do like pickleball puns, and a lot of pickleball wear features puns. I haven't addressed it yet.
I would not even know a pickleball pun if one hit me in the face. What are some pickleball terms?
You know, things that are both terminology in pickleball, like dink and kitchen, and have other meanings in the language. I'm not saying they're clever necessarily, but there's...
I have to say, this is the WPA, the World Pickleball Association. I did not realize pickleball went beyond America. I thought it was like a distinctly American phenomenon.
Yes. Well, much like American baseball teams and some Canadian teams play the World Series. So I guess in that sense, it was a world event yesterday. Although really, it was a small gathering of older people in Los Angeles.
Idea for movie. Joshua Molina trains the national Jamaican pickleball team to an Olympic medal.
Liel, do you have any wins lately? Like, can you even compete with that? Or are you just a dink? Did I use that right? I definitely didn't.
I have no wins. Stephanie, you and I feel we've been through a lot this week. Do you want to set the scene to where we spent our last couple of days? What did we survive this week?
I will say, I wasn't as affected by this experience as you and some of our colleagues, where we had our first ever tablet retreat. We went up to the Catskills to like a retreat center and did like workshopping, things like that.
I'll say this began when a colleague said, these are a bunch of truly horrible, uptight people. The thing that they need is a yoga retreat. Bring all these anxious Jews to a yoga center, kind of a Zen Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist monastery compound type situation up in the mountains. And immediately they will become better people. They would be relaxed. They would be at one with their oneness. Everything would be okay. Whoever made this decision really, really, really overestimated us, I feel.
Look, we went into nature, basically. I would say that we went into nature and everyone dealt with that in their own way. And then on the second night, the power went out. When the power went out, it also meant the Wi-Fi went out. And that's when you really saw panic set in the eyes of our coworkers who suddenly couldn't like get on Instagram or things like that.
To be fair to the panicked brigade, the same storm that took the power out also resulted in a tree and a power line that blocked all access to and from our compound. And this is after 2 days of complaining bitterly about the food, because as you can imagine from a Tibetan Buddhist retreat, the food was, shall we say, particular. A kitchen may be a pickleball term, but it is certainly not a term that anyone at that retreat knew very much about. It was all glop. It was unidentifiable glop with all kinds of ingredients that no one could win or pronounce. As I said in the retreat, I'm pretty sure we won a few wars just so that we would never have to eat like this. And at some point, it got very taxing because the alcohol that we brought, though copious, because of course alcohol is not allowed on the premises of the Tibetan Buddhist retreat, was running very low. And so it was with empty stomachs and full hearts that the storm took out the power line, only to inform us that our plan to leave immediately and go to the nearest pizza joint and have a great time is not going to come to fruition.
It was about like 25 minutes in where Liel stands up in the dark. We're all being illuminated by our iPhones. And Liel says, all right, if this doesn't resolve itself in 10 minutes, my car is going back to civilization. And all these people cheered. And then, of course, we find out that there is, in fact, a downed power line and trees blocking our one road of egress. And it quickly turned into a real team building experience. And you saw people's true metal. When you test people, you see what they're really made of. And it turned out that we were made of like mushy Upper West Side. Like we weren't made of much.
Now, sadly, not for us, but for them, our partners in this retreat, the other group at the same center, were a host of death doulas, which apparently is a thing. Those are people who just like doulas who help you bring life into this world. They help you leave. And these very nice people, by all accounts, were sitting there in the dark and chanting, which of course disturbed us greatly because it was much too serene and lovely for our taste. At which point we attempted to converse with them, which resulted in this great conversation, which one of our colleagues walked up to the head doula in chief, the headest doula, and said, how do you know if you're doing a good job? I mean, it's not like you could ever get feedback from your clients. At which point the doula just looked at him and be like, who are you? You all are very awful people.
My favorite part was like the people there had a very Buddhist attitude. Like the power was out. It was going to come back on. When it came back on, they had a generator for certain areas. And it turns out that is not the answer that antsy New Yorkers want to hear.
Do you guys not have any epigenetic trauma in you? Leave. Escape. What are you doing here?
That's not a scam. It's not a scam. They pull up Buddhist retreats. Oh, the power's out. No Wi-Fi. That was real.
If they did, it would be the smartest thing in the world. But this tells you everything you need to know about this here podcast, because the moment of glory belongs just before the storm started. This show's showrunner, Courtney Hazlett, stopped by the nearest pizza place, waltzed in, and 20 minutes later returned with like an armful of 3, 4, 5 pizza trays, wine, and everything that we needed to sustain us through the storm. At that point, of course, we did not yet know that we would be shut in. But it was all over a heroic effort. I had a very good time. Even the ladybug infestation did not dampen the spirits of spending a lot of time with your colleagues in a muddy upstate retreat.
It sounds like of the three of us, Melina, you are the one winner.
Is that right? I won this week? What do I get?
You get the third place.
I get third place out of the three of us, you're saying?
No, you get first place.
Sounds to me like I lost.
You won. You won for first.
All right.
You get the Golden Paddle Award, the Paddy, if you will.
News of the Jews, oh yeah. N-O-T-J, News of the Jews.
News of the Jews. Here's today's headline, Jewish Woman Changes the World. I rewrote that myself, but this is about Ruth Gottesman, who is the woman who recently donated $1 billion to a medical school in the Bronx. It's the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And the directive with the gift is that it be used to cover tuition for all students going forward. And that is just the most amazing thing ever.
Can I say, I thought so long and so hard about like what kind of, you know, smart alecky,
yeah, like how
funny
could you ruin
thing
this?
I could say. I absolutely have nothing to say except for Ruth Gottesman, you're a freaking legend. This is incredible. Incredible, incredible. And if, you know, more rich people were less interested in sending penis-shaped objects into space and more interested in, I don't know, helping people become better doctors without incurring incredible amounts of debt, we'll be a little bit better off as a society.
Unbelievable.
Let me give you a little bit more info. She's a former professor at the medical school where, according to the New York Times, she studied learning disabilities, developed a screening test, and ran literacy programs. This is one of the largest charitable donations to an educational institute in the United States, and most likely the largest to a medical school.
The money was left to her by her late husband, David Gottesman, who was known as Sandy, which I actually really like. I think we should bring that back. And he was a protege of Warren Buffett. And this is basically like Berkshire Hathaway stock that he left to her and said, like, do something important with this. But here's the best part of the story. A condition of the gift is that the school not be renamed for her. So most people, when they give a university a lot of money, what they ask for or usually demand is that like a school get named in their honor. And she gave the best quote. She says, "We've got the gosh darn name. We've got Albert Einstein."
I think it's fantastic. That is a strong break with normative Jewish philanthropy, or maybe all philanthropy altogether. So I always laugh whenever I visit the University of Judaism here in LA, everything is named. The Esther and Marvin finger hut bench. Like everything you pass, every object has been paid for and there's
the
a name
Joshua
on it.
The Joshua Malina pickleball court.
Pickleball court, right. Yes.
It's sculpted entirely out of bronze. But yes, I think that's awesome that she's giving $1 billion with a B and requires no naming to be done. Maimonides would be proud.
It's amazing. But Ruth Gottesman, we will say your name.
Every time you hear about these like large philanthropic efforts and like people start squawking, this inevitably some person says like, "What do you care? Rich people should do whatever they want with their money." And of course, you know, it's 100% true, naturally. But if you're a very rich person, at some point, don't you want to feel... I mean, I'm not talking rich person at the level of like, oh, I have $30 million. I'm talking like I have $30 billion. At some point, don't you actually want to stop and consider what impact you are going to have with this spending? Because you do want to leave some kind of mark. And if so, like, wouldn't you want to stop and look at this example and see like, wow, there actually are things that we could do here in this world that make a tremendous freaking difference?
Speaking of making a tremendous difference, let me read you this headline from the New York Post. Jewish singles flock to Philadelphia matchmaking conference Yentacon to meet that special someone. I have to say, before we even get to the story, I have to break down something that bothers me deeply and happens pretty regularly across society. And that is this idea that a yenta is a matchmaker. It's not true. A yenta is not a matchmaker. It all comes from Fiddler on the Roof, right, where the matchmaker is named Yenta. But a yenta is not a matchmaker. A yenta is a yenta, like a busybody, someone who's up in your business, not necessarily a matchmaker. So I think it's really, really important that we just like clear the air right now.
But actually, what you're saying is like not all yentas are matchmakers, but all matchmakers are yentas, for sure.
Yes.
Right? I mean, come on. Yentacon is the opposite of SantaCon. You know, SantaCon is just a bunch of drunken Santas who lead to nothing but mayhem and loneliness and despair. Yentacon leads to some shidduchs.
It's amazing. This is the inaugural Yentacon, and it was billed as the first matchmaking conference in the country, designed to match members of the tribe. And here's a quote from the article. "It's the year of the Yenta," declared NYC Yenta Bonnie Winston, who says that matchmakers are working overtime trying to pair up singles looking for a Jewish connection in the wake of the October 7th Hamas attacks amid a surge in anti-Semitism. So this is a topical...
Because by the way, before October 7th, no single Jews were looking for... No single Jews had mothers. Right. So like, so when are you going? When are we going to dance at your wedding? This is a brand new phenomenon only after the Hamas October 7th attack. One of the many ways in which it changed us.
It turned out Jewish people like to marry Jews.
So what happens at Yentacon? There are no singles there. It's the yentas, or the matchmakers rather, who are comparing whom have you got? And do I have somebody for that person?
Yes, there were PowerPoint presentations, according to the article. Matchmakers showcase their clients during PowerPoint presentations, including The Bachelor from New York City with a beach house in East Hampton, The Quirky Disney Addict, The Self-Made VC, and... I'm reading this. I did not make this up. And the holy grail of matches, the single Jewish doctor.
Now, look, I don't know a lot about matchmaking at all, but I'm going to guess that if you show the following four people, you have the person with the beach house in East Hampton, the self-made VC, the single Jewish doctor, and the quirky Disney addict. I'm saying one of those is not getting a shidduch at the end of Yentacon. But he likes Mulan. It's his favorite movie. He cries with Moana.
But yeah, so all the yentas came together, I guess, to like pool their resources and say like, "I got this person, do you have this person?" And it's like a fantasy football draft night, I imagine, having no understanding of what that is, where everyone's like, "I got this, who's got this?" And I bet it led to a lot of matches, not unlike SantaCon, but these hopefully will be more enduring.
I just love the fact that that Bonnie, by the way, unimprovably named the yenta, named Bonnie, said, "It's the year of the yenta. It's like, what if like the Chinese New Year's, we also had like the year of, like the year of the dragon breath? It's the year of the Yenta. It's the year of the Schmear.
Year of the Pulky.
It's the year of the Nudnik. That'd be very cool. Matchmaker, I'll bring the veil. You bring the bride, slender and pale. Bring me a ring, cause I'm longing to be the envy of all I see. For Papa, make her stop for Mama. Make a race to the king for me. Well, I wouldn't holler if her name was Natalie Portman. Matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a fine, catch me a catch. Nine after nine in the dark, I'm alone. So find me a match of my own. Look, we here on the show talk a lot about Israel, a country currently at war. We are, as a Jewish community, sometimes define ourselves as the diaspora, as in the Jews who are not in the land of Israel. But there is another nation out there who is also currently at war and also has a large diaspora that cares very much about this conflict with its very difficult neighbors. And I'm talking about Armenia, a nation which, as you know, listening to the show, I care about deeply and have had the good fortune of visiting. And now it is the subject of a new documentary called Armenia, My Home. It just aired on PBS and it's available. And it really kind of struck me how incredibly Jewish the whole thing was, because if you really just subbed five of the words in this documentary to be like, the first time I landed in Tel Aviv instead of Yerevan, like, I felt, oh my God, a lot of people who look like me. Like, it is really like a bizarre way of thinking about our own Jewish identity through a totally different people's narrative and conversation. And so, Joshua Malina, Los Angeles pickleball champ Joshua Malina, and myself sat down to talk to director Andrew Goldberg. Andrew, welcome to Unorthodox.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us about this incredible film that I already had the privilege of watching, but everyone listening would have the joy of watching very soon.
Well, the film is a journey through the land of Armenia, which a lot of people don't know is a free and independent country, albeit very small. It's located just north of Iran and south of Georgia and Russia. And it's to the right or the east of Turkey and to the left of Azerbaijan. It's in a very complicated is a nice word, neighborhood. And it's interesting because it's a kind of a mix of East and West. It's got a lot of a European sort of flair to it, along with a heavy dose of Middle Easternism and Russian-Soviet influence. It's really unlike any other place in the world. And I was really excited that PBS wanted us to do a film about this place. It's not a place when people say, here's where I'm going to go next year. I'll book a trip. You know, you don't say, oh, I'm going to go to Armenia. And yet we decided to make a film about it. And we were really happy with how it turned out because it's such a fascinating, interesting, layered, complicated place with a big history, which parallels Jewish history in a lot of ways, I think, because, you know, they too had a country try to completely eradicate them from the face of the earth with their genocide, which happened in 1915. In fact, Hitler said, who remembers the genocide of the Armenians? So as a Jew, there was a parallel for me there. There always has been.
That was the event, in fact, that coined the term originally for genocide, correct?
Well, so the term was put together, I believe it's genos meaning group and side or side meaning to kill from the Latin. I don't remember who assembled the word originally. I actually do know. I just can't come to it off the top of my head.
Lemkin, I think.
It was Raphael Lemkin.
It was Lemkin, but I don't know that. I think there was he had some linguistic help. So Lemkin then tried to make it get it passed. The United States, you know, have various laws passed, but I actually did find some amazing interview with Lemkin talking about the Armenians that no one had ever seen before in an earlier film I did on the Armenian genocide. By the way, that's how I learned about the Armenians. I had been taking a course on Holocaust in college, and he said, well, you don't know about this, but there's what we would call the hidden genocide or the forgotten genocide. This was in 1987 or 8 or something like that, and I had never heard of Armenian anything.
And so when you first started this thing, I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, well, yeah, they had a genocide. We had a genocide. I kind of get that. It's a totally different thing to capture the emotional depth that you capture in this film, because a lot of it is not just about the history, but a lot of it is about life in Armenia right now, which has to do first and foremost with this idea of diaspora, which is, of course, something that Jews understand innately. this notion that even though you're born in Australia or Lebanon or, you know, Glendale, somewhere across the world, there's this magical country. And when you land there, all of a sudden, even though you may not speak the language, you may have never been there, all of a sudden it feels like you're home. Explain that.
I would be lying if I said that the Jewish parallel is not very much connected to my interest in this story. It is. It really comes down to this notion of survival. Certainly there's a sense in my community, Jewish community, meaning my family who was from Chicago and what have you, that we had left, you know, our homeland, which was Eastern Europe at the time, and that it was our responsibility here in the United States to keep this going, whether it was our religion, our language, our food, our culture, our gestalt, whatever you want to call it. What did that mean? And in fact, when I made my second documentary ever, it was called The Armenians, A Story of Survival. And the beginning of the film was, there's this giant stone called the Behistun Stone in Iran, which has carved all the names of the countries that the Persian king had conquered. And all of them are gone except one, and that one is Armenia. And so I continually was thinking about the parallels with what my grandmother and what my family had told me about this desire that people don't necessarily want us to exist for any number of reasons, and that it's our responsibility, certainly without a homeland or certainly outside of our homeland. We had Israel and they had Armenia, but here in the United States, we have Big Macs, Burger King, and McDonald's, and all the things that subvert ethnic culture. Before you know it, you throw your fish sticks in the oven and you're drinking a soda and you've forgotten sort of who you are. You've just become this bland sort of American. And that was my sort of fear as a Jew. I want to instill that in my kids. And I brought that parallel to telling this story, which I think is very much part of the Armenian zeitgeist. We have to continue who we are. And now we have a country. Only in the last 30 some years do we have a country, but we finally have a place that is going to help us exist. I don't think that when people are Italian or Greek in this country, they're saying to themselves, oh my goodness, there's a chance that we could no longer exist. That theme runs through Jewish thinking. It runs through Armenian thinking. And I think that was a parallel that was very, I don't want to say attractive to me, but interesting.
And sadly, it's not just, you know, ancient history. Just like contemporary Israel is fighting, you know, war for its very survival, contemporary Armenia is undergoing what some have, I think, very rightfully described as a full-blown genocide perpetrated by the Azeris in Artsakh, sometimes referred to as Nagorno-Karabakh. You touch on that a little bit in the film, but what is it like to make a movie at a time where the country is still very much engaged in war for its survival?
Look, the Karabakh thing is, it's interesting and it's complicated, much like Israel is. There are no sort of one-dimensional simple answers. I think people like to throw platitudes at a lot of these things. You know, here I am just 2 seconds before I got on here reading about, you know, an article about someone's contextualization of Gaza. And of course, 80% of the things they say are wrong. I mean, and this is sort of the ugly nature of geopolitics, right? I mean, it's never a clean situation. I can say this. It is a much cleaner situation with Karabakh than one might expect. I when I was over there, they wouldn't let us in. The Azerbaijanis had blockaded the one road that lets you in to Artsakh, and they were not letting anybody in. They were not letting anybody out. No journalists were going in. And ultimately, they just attacked with their military after we left, took the entire thing and drove the entire Armenian population out. That meets certain definitions of genocide in that regard. At least it was not a mass murder. I'm glad they didn't kill. There's over 100,000 people that live there. I'm glad that they didn't kill them. And we had to then edit the film and add this into the film because this had not originally happened. Originally, my interviews all said Azerbaijan has blockaded Artsakh. Now the film was changed before it went to air, before it was released, to say Azerbaijan has taken it and driven out all these people. That's a human rights violation of the worst order, no matter how you cut it. There are simply no Armenians there. There might be a few families. I've heard that there may be even some prison camps. That's a pretty tragic human rights catastrophe, any way you look at it.
One of the most amazing things that the film captures very beautifully, you know, I had the pleasure and privilege of spending some time in Yerevan. And even in the middle of conflict, even in the middle of uncertainty, I was completely struck by how lively and hopeful it really seemed to me. No one I talked to was in despair. No one I talked to was consumed by rage. People were committed to keeping on, committed to being the best that they can in a way that really struck me much more gritty and resilient than you may expect of a population dealing with so many hardships. Tell us about the feeling that you got when you set foot in Yerevan and really started making the film and talking to the people.
First of all, you know, I have a camera, so I'm going to get a lot of interesting people always, you know, you see a camera and they do a little dance for you. So in that sense, I think we get a slightly biased version of things that might show a little bit more optimism among the optimistic and a little more pessimism among the pessimistic. But there certainly is a sense of optimism there. There's a sense of enthusiasm there. I think they are united by a common purpose and a common cause. I don't think that if you go to Italy or France, there's a sense that we could be gone and now we're getting a second chance on life. But there's a little of that in Armenia. This is a people that came out of so much hardship and suddenly they're doing really, really well. And that's a good reason to be excited and enthusiastic. That's not to say they don't have their share of, you know, curmudgeons. We met plenty. But I do think that there's a sense of Armenia being very much a current event and a work in progress, a community working toward a common goal, a collective enthusiasm that you don't see. I do have not been back since the Artsakh was taken and all those refugees came in. And I understand that's taking a toll on people. But, you know, there's a sort of an interesting enthusiasm in the community that I don't see in other groups. And it's infectious and it's made telling the story a lot of fun. They're very appreciative. There's a surprising amount of humility. They're excited that this funny Jewish guy is telling their story as opposed to, you know, I don't know. I think a lot of other communities would not want me anywhere near telling their story. Now, granted, I have a long track record of doing it, so maybe I'm given a pass. But, you know, there's a lot of like, oh, you know, when I say an Armenian word, everyone's excited about that. You know, if I say thank you in German to someone, they don't, you know, whatever. Yeah, sure. That's a neat thing about the community. So, and it makes it fun. And they'll feed you, by the way. Every time you go to an Armenian home, you can expect to be fed.
And fed well.
Another connection to Jewish culture. And the film is narrated by Andrea Martin, one of my all-time favorite comedians and actors.
Andrea Martin's family name was Papazian. So Andrea tells the story that her father saw the name Martin on the side of a truck. So he took the name and later he took the truck. That's a whole nother story.
Andrew Goldberg, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Got a letter in the mailbox. Got a letter in the mailbox. Mailbox.
To the mailbox. Hello, I love your podcast. I am not Jewish and I learn a lot each week from all of you. By the way, this is the nicest start to any note we've gotten, and it's because she's not Jewish.
Although you didn't even have to say, like, I love your podcast. It's like, okay, nice. And I'm like, here's what you got wrong.
Don't even need to tell us you're not Jewish. You're opening with a huge compliment.
I started listening when Joshua Malina joined the podcast. Yes, that Malina boost.
Boom.
I just wanted to note that it's not only Catholics who observe Lent. Episcopalians observe it as well. While being Episcopalian is often called being Catholic light as a joke, Lent is fully observed in the Episcopal Church. Since you teach me so much, I wanted to return the favor in case you did not know. Thank you for all you do. I learn a lot as a Gentile, and I look forward to learning more. Sincerely, Don R. Don R., I love you so much. I do not think I knew this, and I'm a religion major. I was a religion major and then went to grad school for religion, so I should know that.
And I'm glad that Don wrote in, because I remember when you guys were considering offering me the job to co-host, I guaranteed I would bring in 1 to 5 new listeners. I've now crossed the bar.
You were like, you know what? I could really get you that Episcopal demo. That is what That's I really right. do well with.
I told you I could bring that in.
Joshua, why don't you read the second one?
Because it's a real Malina love fest here today.
Oh, am I getting, wow, am I getting another mention?
Yes.
Wow, what a week I'm having. First the bronze and now, hi. I don't know how I found your podcast, but when I heard Joshua Malina, misspelled, but I don't mind, when I heard Joshua Malina on it, I thought, yes, I cried when he left Chutzpah. Not so much because he left, but Rabbi Shira's blessing on him brought me to tears. That's sweet. I love your podcast. Your banter and spread of ideas is a perfect balance, especially during these unsettling times. I'm trying to catch up on all your previous episodes. Meantime, you have my attention. Excellent interview with Dr. Phil. By the way, I had to Google Fiesta wear. Here in Australia, it's just melamine that you buy at IKEA or Kmart. That comes from Gilda Cohen Shapira of Sydney, Australia. Look at me, 2 mentions.
You're the mensch with 2 mentions.
Hallelujah. Let's see if you could make it to 3. Shalom. We're new listeners to your podcast and enjoying it very much. We deeply resonated with the listeners struggling with shul becoming like an IRL doom scroll, as you so perfectly put it. We are young professionals in the Northern Virginia area outside of D.C., and like so many, have been seeking familiar Jewish tradition and community since 10-7. For the first time as adults, We have been trying to find the comfort of the services we grew up with, but we have been struggling with the sermons at our synagogues being overly political. This last Friday night at, they mentioned a name, but let's give everyone the benefit of the doubt. The sermon, quote unquote, was a 15-minute local news update about a group of anti-Israel Palestinians who have partnered with the Human Rights Commission to file a ceasefire demand with city council and all of the nastiness around these local politics. He even said something dark like, he doesn't feel God in Alexandria tonight because there's no love between neighbors, and said that the Palestinians were yelling that the IDF were baby killers. Afterward, my friends and I were wondering, where's the moral guidance? Where's the Torah? Where's the search for common ground? Where's the reminder that the small local anti-Israel activist group can't hurt us as much as strengthening our relationship with our true neighbors can help us? I think Reform synagogues do tend to be more political than the conservative or Chabad synagogues, but we struggle to find people in our age group at the more religious synagogues. I'd be interested to know if people are noticing this political environment across all sects. Also, figuring it can't hurt to ask, if you're aware of a conservative synagogue in the Northern Virginia or DC area where there are some young people and young families in the demographic, we would love the recommendation. Thank you, Hannah and Kay. This is really interesting. First of all, I'm not at all sure that politicization of sermons is something that only Reform synagogues are guilty of. I could think of plenty of Orthodox synagogues that do the exact same thing. But I think the point here stands. Even if the point of view you hear from the Bima is one with which you totally agree, the space that we seek is not that. The space that we seek is just a place to be together and practice Judaism and hear a little bit of Torah. And sure, sometimes the real world will invade the sermons, and sometimes it's okay, even necessary, to inject a little bit of righteous fury from the pulpit. But for the most part, I, for one, Hannah and Kay, completely understand and share your yearning for a religious space that just does Torah and lets Jews be together in a beautiful, meaningful way.
It's funny. I feel like in like the weeks after October 7th, when it was just like incoming all the time and just like all the videos, I think I went to a workout class and like had to put my phone outside and like was in a dark room for like 45 minutes. And I was like, oh, this is good. Like, you kind of can unplug. And in a way, I feel like people want a break from this onslaught of news and think pieces and opinions and takes. And it's like, it makes me sad that if you're getting people in the door who might not want to go, right? Just as with Yentacon, people want to go to synagogue now. And if then they're just finding the same shit that they're getting everywhere else, right? The same, like, in your face, must think about this, must know what you feel, must blah, 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 blah. Like, they're not going to go back. And so I think it's this real turning point where I get that people have people in the door they don't usually, like, what do you do with these people now that they're here? I think every rabbi and every congregation is like making a different decision, but you really, really see this could be, you know, a way in which people feel alienated because what they actually want is like the Jewish stuff.
I think, you know how they used to have sometimes these pushka boxes in which every time you said a bad word, you had to put like a coin for charity. I think we should do the same thing. Every time you have the urge, like, go on Twitter and look at people you agree with, or more likely kind of rant at people you disagree with, you have to read a page of Torah. You have to automatically open Chabad.org or Safaria or something like this and study one page of Torah.
Spiritual swear jar.
That's exactly right. A spiritual swear jar.
I like it.
Have the Safaria app always open on your phone, and every time the finger goes on, I don't know, some celebrity you hate, Instagram or something like this, be like, oh, now I have to spend 15 minutes studying something.
Tell us how you're using your spiritual swear jar at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or leave us a message on our listener line, 914-570-4869.
Elon Levy, my man, started his professional career as a tablet contributor, but now he serves as the official spokesman of the Israeli government. And as you might imagine, he's been, you know, a little bit busy these last couple of months. We talked to him about what it's like to do that job these days and about his very famous viral interview with Sky News, otherwise known as the eyebrow incident. Here's Elon.
Alon Levy, welcome to Unorthodox.
Thank you. It's good to be here. You know, Tablet magazine launched my journalistic career, which led to where I am now. So all this, it's on you.
I was going to say I went into my inbox to see how long ago we have emailed since, like for how long we've been emailing. And yes. I think 2014 was when you started writing for
Back
us.
Back when I was a student, I started writing for Tablet magazine. It was a fantastic platform to bounce back ideas and develop them and never look back since.
And so explain to our listeners a little bit about where you are and what this role of yours means and what it entails,
These have been the longest and weirdest 5 months of my life since the October 7 massacre. I wasn't a government spokesman when 10/7 happened. I was simply a private citizen.
With a posh accent, which we don't have.
You could say, which definitely helps on American television. I was a private citizen. And when the war started, everyone in Israel dropped everything and realized there was only one thing that mattered right now. Hamas had invaded us. It was taking hostages. There was a war and only one thing matters, and that's victory over Hamas and bringing back the hostages. So I started giving interviews from my living room as a former spokesman to the president, to the foreign media. And within a week, in a very, very surprising twist of events, found myself putting on a suit and tie and being called in this emergency mobilization to go on TV as an official government spokesman.
I love you, man.
I love you too, Liel.
And I'm so grateful for everything that you're doing and want to celebrate you. But before we do any of this, I want to ask the kind of seminal, kind of like asshole question that I think is kind of needs to be asked, which is this. You're going there. You're sitting on BBC, Sky, whatever. You know in advance, or maybe you don't. You'll tell me if I'm wrong. But you know in advance that they're not really there to give you a fair shake. You know that it's all a circus. You know that your job here is basically to play the loyal opposition to whatever decision these people have already made. Do you think any of this matters? Do you think you sitting there and being like, no, guys, this is our point of view, does that even make a dent in what seems to be increasingly foreordained conclusion that everybody hates us?
Of course, it makes a huge difference. Look, I don't think everyone hates us, and I've had experiences in studios with anchors who've seemed very fair and genuinely inquisitive and want to learn. The British journalists always try to crucify you and catch you on a gotcha and say, haha, I've got you to prove that you don't know, or to admit that not all journalists are like that. But I remember that when I'm being interviewed, it's not the anchor I'm trying to persuade. It's the audience at home. It's the people who are washing the dishes and watching their kids and trying to lead normal lives and don't necessarily wake up thinking about Israel and go to sleep thinking about Israel. We do it. It's not a very healthy habit. And those are the people we are trying to persuade. And so even if the media are not giving me a fair shake, sometimes it's the tough interviews that give me the best opportunity to make our case forward because they can see that I'm being pressed and being asked tough questions. And you just have to stand firm and give the answers and polish the sound bites and hope it begins to cut through.
Are there particular organizations in the United States, news organizations, that you feel are more balanced or fair?
I think that the American media, by and large, from the interviews I've had on television, I felt most of the interviews have been fair. I've been pleasantly surprised by CNN in the course of this war. I think they've done a fantastic job shining a spotlight on the atrocities that Hamas perpetrated on 10/7. Very different atmosphere from the British media, very different from the Irish, where sometimes there's almost no point going on because each one is a repetition of how many children do you intend to kill today. But I think in this war, many media outlets have actually been giving us a fair shake. It's becoming harder and harder as time goes on, but I wouldn't write it off, not at all.
I've watched the vast majority of your interviews.
I'm so sorry.
It's a hobby of mine. I love cheering for it, but here's what
you
I'm
see,
feeling.
See, that's not a healthy habit either.
That's
Liel's
what I
not
mean.
Into healthy habits.
Not in even a little bit, but look, my blood pressure rises on your behalf. Like, I'm sitting there watching you, and I get angry for you. It's like, how dare you do this to Alon? When you come off these interviews, like, what do you do? Okay, you stepped out the studio. Do you drink? Do you smoke, like, two packs of Marlboro Red? How do you calm down from this contact sport?
I immediately download the clip, cut it, put subtitles on it, and try to push it out on every possible social media platform. And then I prepare for the next interview.
And there was one November interview that went particularly viral.
Yes.
I was speaking to a hostage negotiator this morning. He made the comparison between the 50 hostages that Hamas has promised to release, as opposed to the 150 prisoners that are Palestinians that Israel has said that it will release. And he made the comparison between the numbers and the fact that does Israel not think that Palestinian lives are valued as highly as Israeli lives?
That is an astonishing accusation. If we could release one prisoner for every one hostage, we would obviously do that. We're operating in horrific circumstances. We're not choosing to release these prisoners who have blood on their hands. We are talking about people who have been convicted of stabbing and shooting attacks. Notice the question of proportionality doesn't interest Palestinian supporters when they are able to get more of their prisoners out. But really, it is outrageous to suggest that the fact that we are willing to release prisoners who are convicted of terrorism offenses, more of them than we are getting our own innocent children back, somehow suggests that we don't care about Palestinian lives. Really, that's a disgusting accusation.
Here's what my answer would have been. My answer would have been, yeah, you're absolutely right. In my moral worldview, the life of a terrorist is not worth the same as the life of an innocent baby. And if you believe differently, then I think that's on you. Tell me why such a militaristic approach is absolutely the wrong thing to say to a wide international audience.
First of all, there are so many possible answers that I could have given at that moment. I don't think that saying, obviously we care more about innocent children who are abducted than convicted terrorists in jail, would have been a bad answer. But it would have been an irrelevant answer, because the reason that we were being forced to release more Palestinian prisoners than we were getting hostages was not that we valued their lives less, and therefore we had to push against that. I mean, what I should have said was not that we would have been happy to release one for one, but we would be happy to get all the hostages out in exchange for zero prisoners, especially if releasing more prisoners would lead them to feel undervalued, which is, of course, the last thing we would want to do. But this was, you know, this was a moment where really changed the course of my public exposure in this war. Within a couple of days, that clip on Twitter got twice as many views as there are people in Israel. And it was a moment where it led to, I had a character on Israel's version of Saturday Night Live, and the eyebrows have become a trademark. It was a funny interview, because as she was asking this question, here's the monologue that was going on in my head. Where is she going with this question? No, she's not. Yes, she is. This is gold. Okay, you need to do something. Okay, ham it up. On the count of three, pull a face. One, two, three. And then I pulled the eyebrows. And I remember telling myself, hold it for as long as you can. Because I realized that there was a TV moment. What a big moment I could not have possibly imagined.
And I think that image of your face with your eyes wide, your eyebrows up, it transmitted a telegraph to all of us watching that, like, the absurdity of some of the situations that we find ourselves all being put in, yes, asking, having to answer for things that don't really even make sense.
And absolutely.
At
no
times
sense.
It feels like it's an unwinnable argument that what you're saying, it's, what do you say? Well, that was a good answer, but it wasn't the right answer. Like, it wasn't what she was asking. I mean, I almost feel like everything is a trap. And it almost seems unwinnable, but you managed to sort of deftly navigate these things.
I mean, the reason that that moment went viral in Israel particularly was that it touched a nerve, this feeling in Israel that sometimes it literally doesn't matter what we do, it literally doesn't matter what we say. There are people who will always make us the baddies. And if our willingness to put dangerous criminals back on the street in order to get back abducted babies is evidence of our inhumanity, then something is completely rotten and warped in the way that you see the world. If you can take even that and your conclusion is, well, clearly the Israelis are the monsters here.
I can't shake this belief of yours that seems profoundly and truly held, that conversation is possible, that persuasion is possible. Do you think that people are still out there, maybe, as if I'm understanding correctly, especially here in America, willing to give us a fair shake?
Well, if it doesn't matter what we say on TV, then why should we complain about media bias and incorrect coverage? If we say everyone's already made up their opinion, it doesn't matter what's shown. The fact is, people are constantly in a process of forming their opinions. There are many people in the middle who don't wake up every day and go to sleep thinking about Israel, who aren't committed.
That's shocking.
Don't have opinion. Yeah, it's shocking to us, but these people exist out there. They walk among us. And I think it is possible to cut through to them. I think we have an opportunity with a section of liberal public opinion. It is difficult. The woke crowd that have gone all in and drunk the Hamas Kool-Aid are lost, and we're never going to convince them. But there is a certain constituency of liberal opinion. They're not woke. They're scared to be on the wrong side of the woke, who need to understand how profoundly twisted the ideology is that is calling for from the river to the sea, globalize the intifada, how much it clashes with what they hold to be their most formative values, values that the state of Israel, imperfect, flawed as it is, blah, 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 still embodies far, far better than any country for thousands of miles around.
Can we talk specifically about what happened with the deaths in Gaza around the aid convoy?
Yeah. Look, I'll say two things about this. First of all, my heart really does go out to the people who got crushed in a stampede as they tried to loot an aid truck. Some people were run over as well by the Gazan truck drivers as they tried to escape. This was the fourth such aid convoy to northern Gaza this week, the first time that this incident had happened. And it's very sad. I feel their desperation. They know that Hamas has been hijacking aid. They've seen Hamas stealing aid. They know that Hamas is selling it on the black market. They know that it's been hogging it for its own fighters. And worst of all, they know that the agencies that are supposed to be looking out for them, like UNRWA, are complicit with all of this and have never and will never condemn Hamas for stealing aid. UNRWA, which is, of course, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. But at the same time, I'm having this sense of deja vu because it takes me back to mid-October and the Al-Ahli Hospital scam. A Palestinian Islamic Jihad rocket shrapnel fell and hit the car park of a hospital. Hamas, which only days earlier had burned, beheaded, raped, and abducted people, and then denied it, put out a press release saying that Israel had launched an airstrike on a hospital and killed 500 people. And that lie went all the way around the world, and people fell for it. And I really hoped and thought that afterwards there would be accountability. Pause for a little bit before you accept the Hamas narrative. And yet again, we saw here these poor people getting crushed in a stampede, these poor people getting run over by truck drivers. Hamas puts out the message saying Israel opened fire at an aid convoy, which did not happen. And that lie goes all the way around the world. And we're having to deal with that misinformation as well. And sometimes you shrug and say, why do I even bother? But you have to keep fighting to set the record straight.
So is it the truth of the matter that there was no firing whatsoever from the IDF?
There was one incident in which many people began running towards soldiers in a way that threatened their lives, and they then opened fire in a way to distance them. But the large majority of people who were killed in that tragic incident were killed in the stampede to try to storm those aid trucks as they were traveling north in Gaza.
So I want to phrase this, make sure I phrase this in the way I mean it, because I, of course, am very, very strongly pro-Israel, as we all are here. Is it not fair to ask whether Israel bears any responsibility for an aid situation that has become so dire that when trucks are trying to get to a distribution center, they become the focus of a stampede?
The problem that we have with aid in Gaza right now is that the UN is struggling to distribute the aid at the pace that Israel is facilitating it into Gaza. You have a whole chorus in the international community saying Israel isn't letting in enough aid. Well, right now, as we record this podcast, there is the content of 300 trucks worth of aid sitting on the Gazan side of Kerem Shalom, waiting for the UN to distribute it. The aid is there, and we have excess capacity at our crossings for more aid to get in, to more than double it. There are 20 operational bakeries in Gaza producing 2.5 million loaves, pita breads, every single day. More than 250,000 tons of humanitarian aid have entered Gaza since the beginning of the war. The problem is the UN is struggling to distribute it. And the reason it is struggling to distribute it is that it relies on UNRWA, which is not an aid agency. It is a Hamas front. It is riddled with terrorists. Not only does it indoctrinate children to terrorism. Not only did some of its members take part in the 10/7 massacre, not only did the UNRWA office sit on top of a Hamas server farm and provide electricity for it, and they're covering it up. It simply is not an aid distribution agency. And we, for weeks, have been calling on the international community to activate the aid agencies that have experience delivering aid in disaster zones and doing emergency relief around the world, instead of relying on this organization that is completely complicit with and in cahoots with Hamas. And we think that's really important that that happen right now to make sure that aid can get to the people who actually need it, and importantly, make sure that Hamas can't steal it. And that's a huge challenge.
Why isn't that happening?
UNRWA has managed to claim a monopoly for itself inside Gaza. And that's a very powerful monopoly that it's managed to claim. And we're trying to push back on that and show the world how much UNRWA has been compromised by Hamas. But many people simply don't want to see it. It's much easier to turn a blind eye and continue giving money to this organization than admit that you've made a massive, massive mistake when all the evidence was right there under your nose.
Now, Alan, look, Joshua and I are middle-aged Jews. Stephanie is still young, but a lot of this war, it's evident, is being fought on platforms that I don't even begin to understand, whose names I can't even often, you know, accurately pronounce. So we wanted to have here an authentic representative of the young, of Gen Z. This is Ani Lutsansky, who will introduce herself in a moment. But Ani, you've been following this and fighting this war very much on social media. First of all, name, rank, serial number, and job description, please.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ani. I'm Tablet's audience editor, and I'm here as, I think, as Stephanie previously described it, a representative of the youth of America and the world.
Representative of the future.
Right, exactly. And I write a Tablet, but primarily I manage Tablet's Instagram, which is something that I decided to do starting in May of 2021 after realizing just how bad things were on the internet amongst Gen Zers specifically with regard to Israel. It felt like we were not getting into the spaces that we needed to be in, and we were not getting into those spaces by leagues. We weren't even in the same room. We weren't in the same house. We weren't in the same state as the right spaces we needed to be in. So what I do and have done for Tablet is try and break down some of our pieces that contain very relevant ideas for the current moment into digestible, essentially, infographics. And we're trying to explain things like the roots of Soviet anti-Zionism that are in so many of the anti-Zionist arguments of today. We're trying to tell people there's history here. There's history into the way that it's been lumped into all these various progressive causes. And we give people something that they can read, not just by going to click on the article, but they can read it on Instagram, which sadly for someone
as
who enjoys
carousel?
Reading. As a carousel. They have a bunch of different digestible quotes from the article. They have pull quotes. They have giant paragraphs of reading, but it's all within the Instagram forum. And it's been very effective because people not only have these quotes that they can share that are digestible Zionists sound bites, the word equivalent of a sound bite, but then they also feel like they've read and they've consumed something. And so there's
based
a way
based on articles that are being
based on articles
on
that have been published on Tablet. We're trying Excellent. To break down these ideas again in a language that young people are speaking, because young people unfortunately don't want to go click on the link in the bio and read a 3,500 word piece about Soviet anti-Zionism.
Right. The Instagram format isn't very friendly for sending people towards links anyway.
No, they won't. And if you're going from something like TikTok or something like that, it's even five steps further back. And so what we've tried to do is make people feel like they have read and learned and consumed something in the right way.
This is a great example, actually, because, you know, talking about this aid convoy, I saw my Instagram account just scrolling through I think it was like a Wall Street Journal video of Israeli troops firing on people running towards the convoy. And that's the one thing you see. There's just a flattening of information here.
Right.
I just see a video and I was like, ooh, that looks not good. So I'm curious for both of you to share a little bit about, you know, Ani, like what it's like for you to run Tablet's Instagram post 10/7, and Alon, for you to have sort of done this role. Yes, it's on TV, but it's also on social media, right? It's your ability to understand and navigate that space.
So what I've been trying to do in this war is to really break the boundaries of what it means to be an official spokesman, to say, look, we're in an emergency. There are no rules. Do what it takes. So towing the line between being government spokesman, a podcast host, government spokesman, and content creator. So we're constantly trying to come up with new and creative ways to get the message out there by saying, if this young generation is getting their news, not by sitting in front of cable TV, but by scrolling endlessly, then I want something that will grab their attention. So how do we make a point about how Hamas's leaders have been living in luxury while condemning their people in Gaza to misery? I sat in Dizengoff Square with a member of my team who wrote a cover of Hey There, Delilah called Hey There, Hania. Hania is one of Hamas's arch-terrorist masterminds in exile, living in obscene luxury in Qatar, having condemned and sacrificed his people, sadly, horrifically, on the altar of their twisted, depraved jihadi ideology. And as he played the guitar, I sang along, and that video went absolutely viral. Hey there, Hania, what's it like at the Four Seasons? You've run 1,000 miles away and led your people and this region into war. Bad guys don't come as bad as you. It's sad but true. Yo, hey there, Sinwa, don't you wonder about the distance? You're hiding underground in Gaza while your bosses drown in riches in Qatar. At least the aid is getting through just to you. I did another example using a chessboard showing how Israel uses its soldiers to protect its civilians. Hamas uses civilians to try to protect its soldiers and tell the story of what is happening through chess and said, let's learn Hamas chess. So constantly trying to find these new and creative ways to appeal to the younger generation, always having to toe a line and not do things that will look too silly, but recognizing that you simply cannot expect to put on a suit and tie and wait for a phone call from CNN if you're trying to get through to the younger generation. That's not how it works.
Liel made a point to me when I came on Unorthodox. I didn't fully understand. I came on in November. And what he said is like, are we going about this the wrong way? Is this the language that young people are speaking? Is there something that we need to do to change this? And I think that the answer to that is yes, we're going about it the wrong way. I'm not sure that the young people want these educational explainers. And I also don't think they're going to be convinced by historical arguments.
I also don't think it's my job to give them a history lecture. I think my job is to give information about what is happening now, but also to try to motivate and inspire the younger generation to then take action for themselves and go out and make the case. So the reason that I'm in the US now is that I flew out for the Hillel International Conference in Atlanta, Georgia, where I gave the keynote speech about what it means to make Gen Z Gen Zionist. And I stepped onto the stage with a t-shirt that we had designed especially with the fingers doing the victory sign and the slogan Gen Zionist, saying Zionism has always been about standing up to bullies. The bullies have come out in force and you need to stand up to them and not let them call you names or define you, and you need to make friendships and alliances, stand up to the bullies. The following day, we distributed in a partnership with the Israel on Campus Coalition, 1,000 of these t-shirts. I was being mobbed by these Gen Z types who wanted t-shirts that said on it Zionist. I don't think that's ever happened before. We're trying to make Zionism cool, to inspire them, gave out a large number of, am I allowed to curse on this podcast?
Please, you're welcomed.
I flew out with 6 kilos of Fuck Hamas stickers. It was a full third of my luggage allowance on the way here, so that they can, if they see, there we go, a producer here has it on the back of his phone, so that when they see these posters saying from the river to the sea or inciting violence or hatred against Jews, they can fight back. And I'm so excited that they seem so excited about that idea, and we'll have to think of ways to try to expand this. But I think part of what the younger generation need is not just information, it's not the history lectures, it's someone to tell them, you're the good guys. Don't let the others call you names. Don't let them attach labels to you. Don't let them make you feel ashamed of who you are. Have courage and keep up the good fight.
Amen.
Absolutely.
I have one last question. There are a lot of people listening to you right now being like, okay, how can we take some of the Alon Leaviness and apply it in our own lives? We have social media feeds. We have followers. We want to do something. Give us the takeaway. Give us the lesson that we could all apply at home.
Look, first of all, I'll acknowledge the challenges that American Jewry is facing that are very different from the challenges I have. It's easy for me thousands of miles away to tell you how you should be fighting. See how fate has reversed itself? But I've heard horror stories about people who are trying to fight back and say they're getting doxxed and intimidated and they're scared for them and their children, for their personal safety. And that's something that people always have to be conscious of. But to the extent that you can, I've been trying in this war to go on the offensive. Because for everyone in Israel, it was so obvious after 10/7 why we are fighting, to bring the hostages home, to make sure Hamas can never do this again, to not give a strategic victory to this Iranian proxy, given the regional strategy of trying to destroy our country. It's so obvious to us why we are fighting. 10/7 was a moral test, and a lot of people have failed it. And I'm trying to call out the people who are failing it. Calling out the Red Cross, whose president fidgeted in her seat when the prime minister said, you need to put pressure on Hamas to see the hostages. And she said, it's never going to work. Pressure on the World Health Organization that can't bring itself to admit that Hamas is waging war out of hospitals. Pressure on UNRWA that has been covering up for Hamas and has been deflecting blame onto Israel to cover up the fact that it's covering up for Hamas. I really think that these agencies and officials who are running interference for Hamas, as simple as that, need to be held to account. And I try as much as possible. Hamas, these agencies, the other officials, they owe us answers. They owe us answers because we know why we are fighting and we cannot afford to be constantly on the back foot and on the defensive. There are others who, in the wake of this horrific, horrific tragedy, owe us answers.
How do you stay sane? And where do you find hope is maybe a different version of asking what Liel asked before. Like, how do you protect your peace?
How do I stay sane?
Yeah,
look, let me do something I do often with journalists who ask me challenging questions. I'll push back on the premise of the question. What makes you think I am sane right now? look, I get a huge amount of hate and death threats and people who I joke are trying not to gaslight us, but Gazalight us, okay? But at the same time, I get so many amazing messages of support online, in the streets where people are stopping me. And that really gives me the courage and the strength to keep fighting because I say, yes, there are all these nasty people whose opinions I've never cared about being mean about me on social media. But all the people I actually care about, my people, the people I'm fighting for, see it and appreciate it. And that really gives me a huge amount of encouragement to keep fighting.
I'm just curious, like, what do you think that regular people who have an Instagram account or who are on college campuses who are facing this question of, like, Israel is in the wrong somehow? Like, we're always coming up against this thing of, like, but Israel's wrong. What would you say is, you know, an appropriate response to that for someone who is, you know, not employed by the Israeli government? What do we who are struggling with how to articulate what's going on, what would you say to us?
For 148 days now, 134 hostages have been trapped in the Hamas terror dungeons. They're being starved. The hostages who come back often lost half of their body weight. In some cases, executed, as we know from sick propaganda videos Hamas has released, and raped at gunpoint. Of the 134, 33 are already dead. Time has run out for them, and we have to keep fighting. There is a baby in there. There is a one-year-old baby who is being held hostage by Hamas. I can't think of anything more sick than that. You know what? Maybe the only thing more sick than that is people telling Israel, write him off. Leave him there. Abandon him. Israelis know why we are fighting because our people were snatched from their beds on October 7th and abducted into the most inhumane conditions. And it's so obvious to us that the hostages are a top humanitarian, ultimately humanitarian mission. And it has been so disheartening to see posters of little kidnapped kids getting torn down all around the world. It really speaks to the extent of the dehumanization of Jews and Israelis. You know, if you've bought into a narrative that says the victim is always right and you don't want the Israelis to be right, you have to deny their victims. In order to deny their victims, you have to deny their humanity. And that's why you tear down the hostage posters. So we are continuing to ramp up military pressure to get the hostages back. It is a personal issue that affects everyone in Israel. It's a small country. No one is more than 1 or 2 degrees of separation away from someone who has lost a hostage. And so we are fighting to bring the hostages home and to make sure that Hamas can never abduct them or steal them. Again, we are fighting so that the kids who were abducted on 10/7 can sleep safely again in the beds from which they were abducted without fear that terrorists are going to come the following morning and steal them away. And so it's so clear to us why this fight is existential. And how disheartening it is then that there are people who try to twist that against us as if they would do anything different, as if they would do anything different if their people and friends and family were brutally massacred and abducted and being held by terrorists for going on 150 days now.
That was what we call a true mic drop. So Alon Levy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Stephanie. Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Liel. I hope to see both of you in person as well.
All right, time for some Mazel Tovs. Let's get things started. Liel Leibovitz.
Oh my God, what a heavy heart as I use this Mazel Tov to bid farewell to the one, to the only, to the great Richard Lewis. It is almost inconceivable that this man is gone. I loved him so much for so long in so many things. And now we've had to say goodbye for him, which is like really kind of in of itself kind of amusing because you would think about him. And there's this famous scene, Curb Your Enthusiasm, in which he and Larry always say goodbye by like cursing each other out or throwing something at one another. And so let's give him the kind of farewell that he would appreciate it. Goodbye already. Love you.
He was the best. I've got a mazel. Mine goes out to Franklin Foer for his excellent, if somewhat depressing, article that is currently out in The Atlantic. It's about the burgeoning anti-Semitism in our country. It's kind of a state of the state for Jews in the United States. And it's called The Golden Age of American Jews is Ending. It's long and very well written and disturbing and important. Well done.
I have a mazel tov to Safaria. Safaria.org is celebrating its 10th year in existence. It's a website and it's an app that basically decided that the people of the book needed to be digitized at some point. And it's a really, really great online resource for all sorts of Jewish texts. And we say happy birthday. I also have a shout out to Ari Stoner, an ophthalmology resident in Denver, who helped my in-laws' best family friend, the Cohen's best family friend, the other Cohens, Sharon Cohen, had an eye issue while she was away in Colorado. She went to the hospital in Denver. Turns out the guy who was helping her is a fan of our show. And she told me that. I know he wouldn't be allowed to share that because of HIPAA rules, but Ari Stoner, we thank you for everything you did for Sharon Cohen.
And Ari Stoner, if you're a single Jewish doctor, please report to your nearest Yenta.
YentaCon.
Yes, please. YentaCon needs you now. All right, Unorthodox is a production of Tablet Studios. The show is hosted by me, Stephanie Butnick, with Liel Leibovitz and Joshua Molina. We're produced and edited by Josh Cross, Robert Scaramuccio, Quinn Waller, and Ellie Blyer. And our team includes Tanya Singer, Courtney Hazlett, and Jerome Ruske, with help from Sam Hacker and Jordana LaRosa. Our episode art is by Esther Werdiger. Our logo is by Jenny Rosberg. Our theme music is by Golem. And our news and mailbox themes are by Steve Barton. The cover of Matchmaker, you heard at the end of News of the Jews, was by our friend Bram Presser and his band Yidcore. Look them up. You will not regret it. We love to hear from you. Email us at unorthodox@tablemag.com or leave a message on our listener line 914-570-4869. Until next week, put some money in that spiritual swear jar. Shalom, friends. Mm-hmm.